They are ever more useful in our daily lives, but they also feel and act more and more like participation farms. Imagining a different way. Camels, not unicorns. Kickstarter is one of the original and best new power platforms. It has by now raised billions for creative projects, opening up huge new opportunities for artists and inventors. It has led a crowdfunding category that has significantly reduced the dependency of artists on funding from large traditional intermediaries like record labels. Unsurprisingly, Benkler and Carr have fought over what the success of Kickstarter proves. Clearly, it's about raising money to support artists, so it supports the interest in professionalism a la Nick, admitted Benkler. But he went on to argue that Kickstarter's model of funding is closer to Benkler's dream, in that artists would get funded by people ponying up real money without expecting to make big bucks in return because of social motivations. Kickstarter was funded by top venture capitalists like Union Square Ventures. It could easily have made Perry Chen, its first CEO, and his co-founders filthy rich, especially if it sought to further commercialize its core model. But Perry and Kickstarter took a very different turn. In a famous blog post in 2012, as the platform was reaching scale and becoming a cultural touchstone, the founders declared, "Kickstarter is not a store," and introduced measures to steer the site away from simply becoming a way to pre-order a product. Perry decided not to sell Kickstarter or take it public, but to turn it into a public benefit corporation, an emerging corporate and legal structure that binds the company to serve society, not just its shareholders, building on the idea behind B Corporations, B Corps, a voluntary certification for socially responsible businesses. Kickstarter's charter boldly, and in plain English, paints a picture of a very different kind of new power behemoth. Kickstarter will care for the health of its ecosystem and integrity of its systems. Kickstarter will never sell user data to third parties. It will zealously defend the privacy rights and personal data of the people who use its service, including in its dealings with government entities. Kickstarter will not cover every possible future contingency, or claim rights and powers just because it can, or because doing so is industry standard. Kickstarter will not lobby or campaign for public policies unless they align with its mission and values, regardless of possible economic benefits to the company. Kickstarter will not use loopholes or other esoteric but legal tax management strategies to reduce its tax burden. Perry told us about the conversation he had with prospective investors in the early days. "We told people, hey, we're not building this thing to sell it. We're not building it to go public. We think those outcomes are likely to get in the way of actually having the most impact, and we still think we can be a good investment, but we're going to do it in this way. We can think of Kickstarter less like the mythical unicorn that Silicon Valley seeks to capture, that exceptional but rare creature that delivers magical returns, and more like the commonplace camel, which is a little more plodding, but serves a critical function and, well cared for, can sustain investors and society for the long term." A study at the University of Pennsylvania found that Kickstarter projects have created 8,800 new companies and non-profits and a remarkable 29,600 full-time jobs. The platform has generated more than $5.3 billion in direct economic impact for those creators and their communities. Perry thinks many more entrepreneurs can be moved to build camels, not unicorns. "Really, it's to allow the generation that's coming up now, which I think has a lot of this inclination, to be able to know that there's not just one way to do it. Given rising expectations among millennials and those younger about the integration of profit and purpose, more Perrys are not only possible, they're likely." And the logic of his strategy is even more compelling for entrepreneurs creating new power communities, whose fate often rests on how well they cultivate and respect their crowds. The journey and philosophy of Perry and his co-founders shows the path that might take us away from a life of participation farms and toward one that is less extractive and more socially generative. Platforms that meet the circle test. Around the world, experiments are underway that take Perry's impulses much further and begin to reimagine new power models like Facebook, Twitter, or Uber in ways that more meaningfully distribute power and ownership. The University of Colorado, Boulder's Nathan Schneider, is one of the leaders of a growing but still quite academic movement that is championing what he calls platform co-ops, democratically run and governed cooperatives reimagined for a world of peer-based technology platforms, not just farms and factories. This movement wants to turn the participation farm into something that looks more like a digital kibbutz. Schneider points to models in more traditional industries that run along these lines, like the UK department store chain John Lewis, which in 1929 was put into a trust owned by its employees who share in the retail chain's profits and elect representatives to its governing board. For new power platforms, he argues, it is their millions of users, not just those on the payroll, who should share in the value created, have a say in big decisions, and be represented in the governance of these platforms. He has proposed that Twitter's users try to buy it back, arguing that it serves an essential public function. In his mind, for all its challenges, the problem isn't that Twitter isn't working for its users. He cites the powerful justice movements that rely on it as evidence that it is. The problem is that Wall Street's economy has become Twitter's economy. Put a little differently, in Carr's terms, Twitter is underperforming. In Benkler's, it is thriving. The hashtag Buy Twitter movement, championed by Schneider and others, was significant enough that it ended up as one of the five proposals on the table at Twitter's 2017 annual general meeting. It made a strong case for a Twitter that would function very differently. A community-owned Twitter could result in new and reliable revenue streams, since we, as users, could buy in as co-owners with a stake in the platform's success. Without the short-term pressure of the stock markets, we can realize Twitter's potential value, which the current business model has struggled to do for many years. We could set more transparent, accountable rules for handling abuse. We could reopen the platform's data to spur innovation. Overall, we'd all be invested in Twitter's success and sustainability. Such a conversion could also ensure a fairer return for the company's existing investors than other options. This motion was not embraced by Twitter Inc., and it would be very tough to flip Twitter into a co-op in this way. But it points to a compelling alternative vision for us as participants and for the next generation of platform creators. In fact, companies with this cooperative-inspired philosophy and model are beginning to emerge. The photo-sharing co-op Stocksy brings together photographers and filmmakers, giving them an opportunity to license their work. They are a proud platform co-op, but also a serious and growing multi-million dollar business. As they put it, think more artist respect and support, less patchouli. We believe in creative integrity, fair profit sharing, and co-ownership, with every voice being heard. For platform co-ops and similar ideas to succeed, governments will have to make it easier to raise money to scale without relying on big investors or the traditional capital markets. If that had been the case, Perry might never have needed to raise venture capital for Kickstarter in the first place. That means promoting large-scale crowd equity of the kind that BrewDog has relied on, with government playing a role to ensure real accountability and transparency so small investors aren't taken advantage of. To truly reimagine the platform behemoths, we also need to reimagine their algorithms. As Facebook has shown us, social media sites have huge power to alter our consumer preferences, spur or hinder extremism, and sway our emotions with tweaks of code. But today, their algorithms function as secret recipes that serve private interests. Consider how a public interest algorithm might work instead. What might a formula designed to favor the interests of platform participants and society at large, instead of just their owners, advertisers, and investors, look like? It would need three key features. First, the inputs into the algorithm, which shape what content we see and what gets priority, would be fully transparent to the user, including the criteria used by the platform to moderate offensive content or hate speech. Second, every user would have a range of dials that allowed them to alter their world. They could choose to engage with more content they disagreed with. They could filter in perspectives and views from those well outside their bubbles. They could reduce sensationalism. Third, the default setting of the algorithm would apply a public interest test, considering how the platform can better serve its broader circle. This might operate like an updated version of public broadcasting, bringing to the surface content proven to reduce social tension and extremism, and bolster civic discourse, promoting pluralism, and showcasing unserved and underserved communities. Participants and super-participants in the platform and the wider public could have legitimate debates about whether, how, and how much a platform should tip the scales in this way. New power, new platforms, no platforms? A decade ago, none other than the father of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, saw the dangers of participation farms on the horizon. In 2008, almost 20 years after laying out his original vision, he rallied for the building of decentralized social networks that would reclaim his beloved web from increasingly centralizing sites like Facebook. He saw a big prize in a more fluid and pluralistic world of platforms in which online social networking will be more immune to censorship, monopoly, regulation, and other exercise of central authority. Today, he is hard at work on a project to address that very issue, a plan to radically alter the way web applications work, one that would divorce all our personal data and content from the apps and platforms that now, often literally, own it. Berners-Lee's Solid project would allow us to own our own data as part of a personal secure pod in which we would carry around our digital lives. So imagine that, rather than having all your data on a third-party platform, you now take it with you. This is what geeks call interoperability. You walk around with your photos, friends, health histories, a map of all the places you have traveled, a list of all your purchases, even the online reputation you have built up in various platforms, an especially powerful commodity. You are liberated to decide what access you would like to grant, and on what terms, to whom. Solid is much more than a different kind of technology. It is a different philosophy. With Solid, your data reports to you. Another solution to the problem of placing one's data in the hands of a powerful intermediary comes in the great and much-hyped hope of the blockchain. The blockchain is a distributed public ledger that allows everyone to record and see what transactions have taken place. Unlike a centralized secret ledger, such as those of banks, it is transparent, and transactions are verified not by a central force, but as a distributed process. You might know the blockchain from its most famous and controversial application to date. It is the underlying technology upon which the virtual currency Bitcoin is built on. For non-technologists, even those who have spent hours trying to get their heads around this, the way it actually works can be hard to grasp. But the most important things to understand are the potential human applications. As The Economist puts it, it offers a way for people who do not know or trust each other to create a record of who owns what that will compel the assent of everyone concerned. It is a way of making and preserving truths. The potential of this is as huge as the hype, although like all technologies, blockchain remains vulnerable to co-optation and capture. It opens up a world where users might exchange value directly without an extractive middleman. We can easily imagine real estate contracts or financial transactions living on the blockchain. But we might imagine, too, the intermediaries being removed from the mega-platforms of the world, our Ubers or Airbnbs, when drivers and riders, or hosts and guests, work out ways to collaborate and exchange directly with each other. As we look to the future, there is no shortage of predictions about the next participatory technologies and ideas that will transform our lives. Whether it be virtual reality, augmented reality, blockchains, or even the emergence of a metaverse, platforms as we know them today will likely end up feeling rather quaint. But however things turn out, we need to cling to and build for a set of principles that ensure the worlds we will live in are less monopolistic, more transparent, and much more attuned to their broader impact. We, as the participants on the participation farms, can do more than just lament our fates. In a Guardian poll in 2017, less than one-third of Americans agreed that Facebook was good for the world, and a paltry 26% believed that Facebook cared about its users. The poll also showed support for placing limits on the power of the big technology platforms. But there is no reason to leave this work to regulators alone, who will tend to be more focused on blunting the power of platforms than on preserving their benefits to users. Consider some of the stories we have shared in this book, and you can begin to glimpse a movement to flee these platforms that takes on some of the viral and participatory qualities of an ice bucket challenge. And while no movement is likely to empty out the farms altogether, even a relatively modest user rebellion might trigger big changes to policies or leadership, as we saw in the wake of the hashtag delete Uber effort in early 2017. It will take inspired and dedicated applications of new power by technologists, entrepreneurs, and all of us to reinvent the terms on which we participate. Toward a full-stack society. The political thinker and social innovator Jeff Mulgan describes one of the great paradoxes of our age. People were promised that the currents of change, economic, social, and technological, would make them feel powerful. Instead, they see decisions being made by political and corporate leaders ever further away from them. They feel like observers, not participants. He cites research that shows that majorities of people across the world think their countries are on the wrong track. We saw this paradox at work in the Brexit vote, the visceral difference in the minds of Leave and Remain voters, in the view of the British election study, was a deeper sense of alienation. Those who wanted out tended to feel less control over their own lives. In the same vein, Nobel Prize-winning economist Angus Deaton showed a clear correlation between predictors of what he called deaths of despair from drugs, alcohol and suicide, and support for Donald Trump. The fear of automation and the stark realities of income stagnation and rising inequality are all feeding this sense of alienation. Even the so-called winners of globalization feel distant from core social institutions, from government to media to education, as the Edelman Trust Barometer shows. We can vent our frustrations in an instant on social media and find many who will cheer us on. But we may still feel less control over the hard realities of our lives, how we fit into society, and how we engage with our governments and institutions. To close this gap, it will be critical to actually reduce wealth and income inequality and change the material conditions of those who have been left behind. But a subtler challenge is in how we create more meaningful opportunities for people to actively shape their lives and connect with the institutions that shape them. People need to feel more like owners of their own destinies, rather than pawns of elites. If the only meaningful expression of all this pent-up agency is the occasional election or referendum, people will naturally be inclined to use their participation as a way to lash out. Platform strongmen and extremists will offer easy answers. But we need something different. A world where our participation is deep, constant, and multi-layered, not shallow and intermittent. Think of this world as the full-stack society. When coders speak of stacks, they are referring to the different components of software that work together to make a product hum. Programming languages, applications, and an operating system. The full stack is when all of those layers come together to form a coherent whole, both those that we see, the front end, and those that we don't, the back end. This is a good analogy for the kind of world we need to create, one where people can more meaningfully participate in and feel ownership over every aspect of their lives, their engagement with technology platforms, their work, health and education, and of course democracy and the experience of government itself. This cannot come about through one killer app, but requires a cultural and structural shift with institutions of all kinds building deeper and more rewarding routes to participation. The most important reason that people don't trust institutions is that institutions don't really trust people, offering occasional, insubstantial, and often frustrating opportunities to take part. To create the full-stack society, we need to dream up entirely new models that make us feel more powerful and more connected to one another in all our guises, as patients, taxpayers, consumers, neighbors, voters, students, and parents. building up the stack. To help us imagine what a full stack society might look like, here are two stories of people adding layers to the stack in critical areas, one in media, one in government. Each teaches us something about how to make people feel more powerful and how to make society stronger. And they offer a critical lesson. If we want to rebuild public trust in our institutions, we have to let people get their hands on them. From subscribers to protagonists, the story of The Correspondent. In 2009, Rob Weinberg, while still in his 20s, became the youngest ever editor-in-chief of the prestigious Dutch newspaper NRC Next. He was hailed as a boy wonder, and already had a best-selling book to his name. A philosopher by training, and with news in his blood, both his parents are journalists, he had built a reputation as thoughtful and earnest, a throwback to that rose-tinted age of newsrooms brimming with reporters focused on the public interest rather than sponsored content. 2 years later, he was fired. He had tried to move the paper away from breaking news-driven reporting, which he saw as prone to hype, sensationalism, and a short lifespan, in favor of more analysis, coverage of structural issues, and long-form investigative journalism. It is salacious and exciting to ogle the various billionaires caught up in the Panama Papers. But, he told us, it is much more important that readers understand the underlying global system of tax evasion and capital flight. This unusual perspective didn't jibe so well with the business goals of NRC Next's owners, and when he refused to change his approach, he got the boot. This used to be the point where the story ended. In the 20th century, starting a newspaper was a vastly expensive endeavor, requiring all manner of physical infrastructure and capital costs, which is why fired editors didn't usually start new ones. But Weinberg was not one to give up. If he couldn't rethink journalism within an old power institution, he'd do it by creating a new power one. Weinberg laid out a vision for a new kind of publication that would retain the essentials of high-quality journalism while rethinking just about everything else. This new publication would reinvest at least 95% of its revenue back into journalism and the development of its platform. Its privacy policy would explicitly prohibit it from collecting unnecessary personal information about its readers. It would be entirely free of ads. It would be openly subjective, rejecting the myth that journalists were objective automatons, and encourage reporters to actively pursue real-world change. And most central, it would reimagine the relationship between a publication and its readers by turning them into active participants in the journalistic process. He took his pitch to the crowd, inviting people to step up to support his vision and become his very first subscribers. He broke world records for crowd-funded journalism. His creation, De Correspondent, raised 1.7 million euros in 30 days, and on day one, the publication already had 19,000 subscribers, called members. At the core of De Correspondent's proposition is a critical new power idea. As Ernst Jan Fult, Weinberg's co-founder and publisher, puts it, the people previously known as the audience constitute the greatest source of knowledge, expertise, and experience to which journalists have access. Yet this resource has been underutilized for more than a century and a half. He adds, we believe that modern journalists shouldn't see their readers as a passive group of annoying followers. Instead, they should regard readers as a potential goldmine of expert information. This comes to life in many ways at De Correspondent. Every journalist shares their story idea or the question they want to investigate with members before they write a single word. Readers are then invited to draw on their expertise in that topic and share insights, ideas, or leads. Readers are given tools to curate, build on, and adapt material from the newspaper, adding external sources and their own experiences. And every article in the newspaper ends with a question for readers that steers the contributions in the direction the correspondent finds journalistically most relevant. De Correspondent reframes user comments as contributions and has turned them into an integral part of the experience, not an afterthought. Editors and journalists invite specific members to write guest posts in response to articles they have engaged with. They treat readers like experts by allowing them to add a tag to their names, reflecting their areas of special knowledge, and to add their own bio, unheard of on traditional media sites where the only bio you'll see is of the writer. In doing all this, De Correspondent sees itself as cultivating the world's greatest Rolodex, a trusted community of expert contributors from scientists to nurses who help its journalists write better stories and gain a more diverse range of sources and interlocutors. Their readers love to get in on the action. De Correspondent is currently conducting the Netherlands' largest group interview with refugees, asking readers to pair up with refugee asylum seekers, meet monthly to interview them, and share their often ignored stories. Hundreds have taken part. To take another example, when environment correspondent Jelmer Mommers wanted to launch an investigation into Shell, he started with a blog post that asked, "Dear Shell employees, let's talk." Rather than hoarding his findings until the big reveal of an article, he shared his growing knowledge and questions with readers and sought their help. The updates Jelmer published amplified his reach and trust. They brought in new readers and new sources, Ernst Jem Fout explains. One of those readers handed him a treasure trove of documents that proved Shell understood the grave risks posed by climate change decades before it admitted it. A handful of years after its initial crowdfunding campaign, De Correspondent is thriving with more than 52,000 subscribers on a per capita basis, not far off that of major publications like The Wall Street Journal, and it is still mainly in the Dutch language. It has retention rates that most media companies would kill for, 79% on its annual subscription and 89% on its monthly plan, and it is now planning to take its model global. In an era of deep skepticism of traditional media, incessant talk of fake news and a US president who has described the media as the enemy of the people, De Correspondent shows us how to bring participation and a sense of shared ownership back into a vital social function. Those who have lost trust in media are offered an opportunity to get their hands on it, not as passive readers, but as real participants. In doing so, people become part of the adventure. Newspapers like The Guardian and The New York Times are beginning to cotton to this, launching big membership drives that emphasize their higher social mission. But the real participation premium will be won by getting off their pedestals and inviting their readers to join in. Forking Government, the Tale of Audrey Tang. In Taiwan, a brilliant and fearless 36-year-old transgender coder and activist, Audrey Tang, known as one of her country's best technologists, is showing what is possible when new power is brought into the heart of government. Her journey began in 2012 when the Taiwanese government released an ad depicting citizens gazing awestruck at the complex details of an economic reform package that appeared above them. The message was essentially, "It's too complicated for you, but do not worry, trust us. It was really insulting," Audrey told Claire Richard at the Open Culture blog. So a group of hackers made a website that transparently published all government budget data and made it easy for citizens to engage and debate the facts. They called it gov.tw, a clever forking of an official government website address by swapping out the letter O for a zero. The key technical challenge was to create visualizations compelling enough that anyone could understand what the government was actually up to. To do that, you have to scan a lot of data. The Gov wanted to enlist the crowd, but they had to find a technical solution for how to get people involved. If we had asked people to copy an entire page of numbers in an Excel table, that would have taken maybe 4 minutes, said Tang. On the internet, it is already too long. People can find instant gratification elsewhere. They can simply like or share on Facebook in seconds. It should not take more than a minute. It is the limit on the internet. So they cut the vast trove of data on government spending into captures that take just a few seconds to transcribe and added badges to motivate people along the way. As Tang put it with characteristic enthusiasm, "It takes 5 seconds and it really feels like you're helping the country. This is both useful, simple, rewarding and fun. This is the key of crowdsourcing. Whenever there is a way to measure the progress of the player, people can spend hours without sleep to finish the game. The project attracted 9,000 people within 24 hours. Tang and Gov's next trick, in 2016, was to coordinate among the traditional taxi industry, the Taiwanese government, and ride-sharing companies like Uber to figure out a novel approach to regulation. She used an online platform called poll.is to orchestrate a remarkably nuanced consensus-building process that brought 4,500 users and drivers together to propose solutions and live-streamed the decision-making. A new law emerged that extracted major concessions from Uber, including requiring Uber to vet drivers more fully and provide insurance, and that made it easier for civil society alternatives to Uber to spring up. In her journey, Tang went from being an activist operating outside the system to becoming a visionary politician and the youngest minister without portfolio in Taiwan's history. In office, Tang has hired what she calls participation officers, whose job is to create mechanisms for meaningful participation in the work of government by ordinary people, something that seems obvious but somehow still feels deeply unintuitive for the 20th century managerial state. Tang is determined to find ever more ways to get people participating and co-owning the outcomes of government. Platform co-op acolyte Nathan Schneider is on the same push. He believes the key to moderating and deepening our public discourse is for people to be constantly debating, voting, deliberating. He calls this unbundling democracy. I believe in the idea of unbundling our democracy so that you're not just electing one representative to represent you on everything, but to imagine democracy as a series of layered and cascading institutions that you relate to according to your relationship with that service. He imagines this applying to everything from electing the governors of a healthcare system to choosing who runs the big online platforms in our lives. To play this out a bit, think for a moment of the humble and hated annual tax return. Imagine if it were no longer impenetrable and dull, but instead fully immersive and participatory, with every citizen hearing the stories of those people their taxes had helped and seeing where their money had gone. Instead of being a dreaded once-a-year moment, it would provide feedback to citizens throughout the year. People might be surprised by a thank-you video out of the blue from a citizen whose life their tax dollars had changed, the worker in a declining industry who had been retrained, the kids enjoying a new playground, the doctor who had developed a new cancer treatment. People might even get to play a more active role in deciding where a portion of their tax dollars go. Some of this is already happening, especially at the city level. Participatory budgeting is an idea that started decades ago in the Brazilian city of Porto Alegre, but is now spreading throughout the world and merging with internet crowdsourcing culture. Paris's ambitious participatory budgeting program, led by Mayor Anne Hidalgo, has led to hundreds of thousands of Parisians passionately debating and voting on projects close to their daily lives, everything from greening public space to aiding the homeless. This mirrors the success of the citizen engagement and budgeting program in Reykjavik, which has attracted nearly 60% of that city's people. Plans like this must account for the bias inherent in any crowdsourcing exercise, especially the challenge of distinguishing between what is vital and what has viral appeal, and ensuring that they don't mostly benefit the already privileged. But done well, they can serve a larger purpose, giving people a sense of ownership and many more opportunities to participate. These are just a few examples of the kinds of efforts we need in order to build up the stack. It is easy and exciting to imagine more. The health sector, for one, is made for more participation, and in an aging society, it will be a critical place to focus. In fact, greater levels of patient activation have been called the blockbuster drug of the 21st century. National Health Service Innovation Whiz Helen Bevan asks us to consider caring for our health as a contribution to our democracy, an ongoing investment in the personal and public good. To encourage this, the health layer of the stack will need to be built out to enable vibrant patient communities in the style of Patients Like Me, the platform we described at the very beginning of this book. We also see promise in the emergence of data and cloud co-ops for medical histories, places where people can store their personal information out of the prying hands of big platforms and then peer-produce better health outcomes. More routes to deeper participation in domains typically closed off to the public will be key. Take the Volunteer Emergency Services network GoodSam, which started in the UK, allowing ordinary people with first aid training to support and augment big health systems. In the words of Alex Grant, a 19-year-old student paramedic, "As a GoodSam responder, I volunteer my life-saving first aid skills in the local community around me. During one particular GoodSam alert, I responded to a patient a few hundred yards from where I was who had suffered a cardiac arrest. We were quickly backed up by the London Ambulance Service and worked tirelessly for 40 minutes to save this person's life. We managed to get a return of spontaneous circulation. The patient sustained their pulse to hospital long enough for the family to make the 200-mile journey where they could say their goodbyes and hold hands for one final time." Not all stories have a happy ending, but you can certainly try to make a difference through comfort, sympathy, and providing a fighting chance for survival. GoodSam is now big enough that it can be a major complement to ambulance services in UK cities. But it has another advantage too. It helps bring communities closer together and gives people like Alex Grant a deep sense of participation. Across sectors, you can start to imagine initiatives of all shapes and sizes. Think of new power platforms that make it easy for retirees to teach and mentor the unemployed in an age of increasing automation. Huge ecosystems of local face-to-face groups in which people of different backgrounds can form communities focused on anything from learning Hindi to fighting racism. Think of the coming distributed clean energy future that promises to allow ordinary people to capture, use, and even sell power back into the grid and to one another. We all need to build models and seek out models that help everyday people like us gain a sense of ownership and connection to one another and to society at large. Participation needs to be much more than the website that allows you to point out occasional potholes in the street. It needs to be a constant and compelling experience that keeps people working together on the things that matter. Building the full-stack society will be challenging at a time when public support for democracy itself is at historic lows in much of the industrialized world, and especially among young people. And there will always be tension between getting people to show up for things that really count and the easy temptation for all of us to plug into the dopamine machine. It will require that those on the side of the angels get a lot better at delivering a killer user experience, sticky feedback loops, and a compelling set of incentives as they work to restore vitality to our essential social functions. New Power's messy masterpiece. On Reddit, over 72 hours in April 2017, something strange but unexpectedly beautiful happened. It's a tale that in many ways sums up the big unresolved question as we end this book: whether New Power will ultimately do more to bring us together and build a more just world than it does to divide us and exacerbate inequalities. Reddit put a simple challenge to its community. It created a vast, blank, virtual canvas it called Place, in which users were invited to contribute pixel by pixel, with a limit of one per user every 5 minutes, to making one big piece of art. The dominant early contributions were penises, swastikas, and swear words. If you recall the tenor of hashtag Reddit Revolt back in Chapter 5, this won't much surprise you. But soon, the better angels on Reddit responded with pixels of their own. A product manager at Reddit remarked that what was really amazing was seeing how quickly the community organized and started to self-police the canvas to keep it positive. A stunning replica of Van Gogh's Starry Night appeared, and, thanks to the help of others in the community, survived an attack from a nihilistic group of black pixel brandishing contributors who called themselves the Black Void. National flags were drawn. Countries fought and then made peace. Adult fans of Lego inserted themselves to promote their beloved bricks. A man wanted to use Place to make a marriage proposal and enlisted the help of the community to make it look beautiful and keep it there. His plan was cruelly sabotaged but then partially saved by a community that devoted itself to painting hearts. More than 1 million people laid out 16 million pixels to create a complex, chaotic, collaborative masterpiece, by some measures the biggest piece of group art ever. Ultimately, the forces of light outnumbered and outorganized the forces of darkness on Reddit Place, and they did it by embracing collective action and through the strength of their core values. Reddit Place became a metaphor for what a full-stack society might look like, with many expressions of political, economic, and cultural participation represented on one big digital canvas. Everyone who contributed felt like an owner, because each of those million people really was one. Building this kind of world will be messy, and it certainly won't be without pockets of hate, co-optation, and a whole lot of distraction. But it is a world all of us can create together, and it is the one most worth fighting for. Glossary. How to speak new power. An ace idea. An idea designed so that the crowd will take hold of it and spread it. It is actionable because it is designed to make a user do something, connected because it makes a user feel part of a like-minded community, and extensible because it is structured with a common stem that encourages its communities to alter and extend it. Blend power. To bring together old and new power in ways that reinforce each other. Bridge. A new power change agent who can meaningfully connect with the new power world, making the practical jumps between old and new power. A bridge's work is structural. A digital beard is often mistaken for a bridge, but actually provides cover for a risk-averse organization and resides on the margins of influence. Camel. A new power platform or organization that delivers economic returns that are less spectacular than those of its alter ego, the unicorn, but serves an important social function and can sustain investors and its community for the long term. The circle test asks whether the impacts of a new power platform on those both inside its triangle and within its wider circle are positive. Connected connectors. People who are connected to one another, share a worldview, and are influential in their reach. For a new power movement, identifying and cultivating the right connected connectors can be the difference between takeoff and fizzle. Crowd jacking. When a campaign is separated from its original intent through the whimsy of the crowd. Take the rise of Boaty McBoatface. Founder feeling. The increased sense of agency, control, and ownership employees seek, as if they were startup founders, even if they work for someone else. Full stack society. A world in which all major social and economic institutions are designed so that people can more meaningfully shape every aspect of their lives. Harnessing the three storms. Successful movements often build up off the backs of storms, galvanizing moments of human drama and urgency that can be hard to predict, but that provide great energy. Sometimes storms happen, and the movement works to embrace them, even if at first they seem like setbacks. Sometimes a movement sees a storm out in the world and chases it. At other times, a movement creates a storm out of thin air. Leadership compass. Describes leaders in terms of their leadership models and values. The crowd leader combines a new power leadership model with a commitment to new power values. She wants to do more than channel the power of her crowd. She wants to make her crowd more powerful. The cheerleader champions new power values like collaboration, transparency, and participation, but leads in an old power way. The co-opter deploys a crowd and skillfully uses new power tools and tactics, but does so in service of old power values and to concentrate power for himself. The castle pairs old power values with an old power leadership model. This is the traditional hierarchical and authority-based model of leadership most of us grew up with, and which is widespread in sectors like the military, business, and education. Meme drop. A message or idea designed to spread sideways, coming most alive when remixed, shared, and customized by peer communities. Examples: the Ice Bucket Challenge, Pepe the Frog. New power. Made by many, it is open, participatory, and peer-driven. It operates like a current, and, like water or electricity, it's most forceful when it surges. The goal with new power is to channel it. Old power is held by few. It is closed, inaccessible, and leader-driven. It operates like a currency. Once gained, it is hoarded, and the powerful have a lot of it to spend. New power behaviors: sharing, affiliating, funding, producing, and shaping. The old power behaviors are complying and consuming. New power brand: a brand designed to inspire participation. New power circle: the group of interested parties who surround a new power community and can impact its fate and are impacted by it. New power compass: plots organizations along two dimensions, models and values. A crowd is a new power model with new power values. A cheerleader professes new power values but sticks to an old power model. A castle is an old power model with old power values. A co-opter is a new power model used to reinforce old power values. New power decision tree: 4 questions to ask to decide if your organization should turn to new power. They address strategy, control, legitimacy, and long-term commitment. New power models, enabled by the activity of the crowd, without whom these models are just empty vessels. Old power models are enabled by what people or organizations own, know, or control that nobody else does. Once old power models lose that, they lose their advantage. New power triangle: the 3 components of a new power community, including participants, super participants, and the owner or stewards of the platform. New power values: a belief in informal governance, opt-in decision-making, collaboration, radical transparency, maker culture, and short-term affiliation. Old power values include a belief in formal governance, competition, confidentiality, expertise, and long-term affiliation. Occupy yourself: the technique of embracing radical transparency and surfacing your challenging issues, if only as a preemptive strategy, a key task for many old power institutions. Participants: those who take part in a new power platform and tend to form the vast majority of its users. Participation farms: digital platforms that have fenced in and harvest for their own gain the daily activities of millions or billions of participants. Participation premium: the additional value created by bringing together a higher purpose, a material return, and participation within a transaction. The participation scale lays out the behaviors that old and new power models are designed to inspire, from least to most participatory. The most effective new power models know how to move people up the participation scale. Platform owners: the entity that controls who is allowed to participate in the platform and its governance, deciding how value is distributed, and even whether the platform lives or dies. Where there is no owner, platform stewards play sometimes informal leadership roles. Platform strongman: a co-opter who deploys new power tools and methods in order to advance authoritarian values. Problem solvers and solution seekers: terms surfaced by NYU professor Hila Lifshitz Asaf to describe respectively those within an organization who resist efforts to open up to the participation of the wider community and those who more easily make the shift. Problem solvers find their identity in the old power value of expertise, while solution seekers expand the boundaries of their professional world to invite outsiders in. Shapeshifter: a new power change agent in old power garb, a figure with unimpeachable institutional credibility who smooths the path to change. The shapeshifter can be contrasted with the disruptor, the outsider who moves fast and breaks shit. Shaping: how a new power leader influences the overall norms and direction of her crowd, especially in ways that go beyond her formal authority. Signaling: the way a new power leader makes a crowd feel more powerful through his speech, gestures, or actions. Structuring: putting structures and practices in place that enable participation and agency. A new power leader structures for participation. superparticipants, the most active contributors to a platform, and often those who create the core assets that power the platform and create its value. Taking the turn, to move from old to new power. Wewashing, a phrase coined by our friend Lee Sean Huang to describe the way brands sometimes use the language of the crowd and appear to invite its participation without having any meaningful interest in engaging with it. This is Andrew Falaise. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of New Power, How Power Works in Our Hyperconnected World and How to Make It Work for You, by Jeremy Hymans and Henry Timms. This program was directed by Paul Rubin, executive producer Linda Korn. Text copyright 2018 by Jeremy Hymans and Henry Timms. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.